The Tudor History and Travel Show is a podcast that brings Tudor history to life by exploring Tudor places and artifacts in the flesh. You will be travelling through time with Sarah Morris, the Tudor Travel Guide, uncovering the stories behind some of the most amazing Tudor locations and objects in the UK. Because when you visit a Tudor building, it is only time and not space which separates you from the past. And now over to your host, Sarah Morris.
And it's a big warm welcome to the month of May. Yes, my friend Sarah, the Tudor Travel Guide, is back again for another episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. Now, you've probably heard me say it before, but May is one of my favourite months. I think it is one of the best times to be travelling here to the UK to explore our heritage. And maybe some of you out there are getting ready to pack your bags right now and head this way. Because, of course, May is also a big month on the Tudor calendar, with the anniversary of the execution of Anne Boleyn on the 19th of May. And, of course, this year there is another event to look forward to. Yes, of course, we have the coronation of Charles III taking place on the 6th of May. Now, while many people are perhaps less than enthusiastic about the monarch themselves, there is a huge amount of curiosity about seeing this historical spectacle, which has remained unchanged for literally nearly 1,000 years. In fact, on that note, my friend, I ran a very successful coronation summit just a couple of weeks ago, but because there are so many questions coming my way about the event, the history, the ceremony, what to look out for, I thought that I would reopen access to the Coronation Summit. So if you missed my Coronation Summit, which is your essential guide to coronation, unraveling the mystique of monarchy, if you missed it the first time, then worry not, because you get a second bite of the cherry, my friends. Yes, right now you can grab your ticket and get access straight away to the four principal speakers. We have Tracy Borman talking about the history of the ceremony itself. We have Jonathan Foyle talking about the buildings of coronation, notably Westminster Abbey and Westminster Hall. We have Nicola Tallis talking about the regalia of coronation, or the bling. And then we have Aleary Lynn and Anne Butcher talking to us about the robes of coronation. And then finally, we have a wonderful creative endeavour by three wonderful, fantastic ladies, Ashley Risk, Natalia Richards and Rebecca Monet, who've put together a world premiere for us for this summit, which is a creative illustrated account of Anne Boleyn's coronation procession going from Greenwich Palace via the Tower all the way to the doors of Westminster Abbey. It is really sensational. I've had some great feedback about the summit, people saying that they've learnt so much and now feel coronation ready for the event. So if you want to grab your ticket, I will be keeping booking open up until the coronation and for a few days thereafter, but no longer, my friends. So don't miss out. You can grab your ticket now. There will be a link in the description associated with this podcast if you want to find out more about what you will find in the summit and, of course, to get your ticket. Well, that's our first piece of housekeeping. For the second, I promised that in this episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show, I would talk more about my brand new membership, which is called The Ultimate Guide to Exploring Tudor England. Yes, my friends, this is my passion, my long-term project, in which I pull together all the very best of my content, written, audio, and of course visual, and create a rich and diverse source of information for Tudor lovers everywhere. Now, being the Tudor Travel Guide, of course, the focus of TUG, as I call it for short, is, of course, on Tudor places and retelling the stories of Tudor history, the people and the events through the places in which they happened. At the heart of TUG are its itineraries. These are itineraries both by person, and in fact, these are write-ups, detailed write-ups of Tudor progresses. We already have the 1486 progress of Henry VII available for members to read, and the 1502 progress is currently being researched and added to the content library. If you're a little more than an armchair time traveller and you're actually planning a trip here to the UK, you will also enjoy my itineraries by county, so you will get inspiration on where to visit, depending on the part of the country that you're visiting, as well as itineraries by the amount of time that you might have available. By popular request, there are lots of interactive maps. These show places across the UK, so if UK geography is not your thing, but you're wanting to plan your own adventure, these maps are invaluable. There's also a growing catalogue of Tudor tombs. Yes, if you follow me on Instagram, you will know I have a thing about Tudor tombs, and I do enjoy charting them along the way. If you're planning a trip to the UK, you may also enjoy my growing library of historic accommodation. So yes, if you want to add the icing on your cake of your trip by staying at somewhere medieval or Tudor, then you will find a growing list of write-ups of some of the best places that I have encountered along my travels. Then there's the live action. You can catch me in dialogue with curators, historians, authors on a monthly basis on my live Tudor talk. And twice a year, I'm also going to be running travel masterclasses for people, again, planning a trip to the UK who want very specific and detailed information along a particular theme. So last year, we did one on Tudor London Made Easy, and the next one that's coming up at the end of May will be Great Tudor Days Out from London. There's access to all my previous virtual summits on demand, and depending upon the level of membership, you will also have access to my current summit free of charge, and many people have taken advantage of that, as well as my most detailed videos that I am recording to accompany the write-ups of the progresses contained within the membership. We also, of course, have this podcast. So previously, you were able to access full-length versions of this podcast if you were a member of my Patreon. Now, so many people wanted me to centralise all my content under one roof, and that is what TUG does. And so now, if you want to listen to the full-length episodes of my podcast, you can do so by becoming a member at either level, armchair traveller or road trip traveller level. And last but certainly not least, there is a community board. This is where like-minded Tudor history lovers come together to share their passion of visiting and learning about Tudor places and really just Tudor history in general. I think it's a great place in which to make new friends who share your interest. Or in fact, I'm hoping in time it would also be a great place to find a travel buddy, because I do get people asking me, oh, do you know anybody who lives da 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 da? So, well, it would be lovely to link people up and think of new friendships taking root. So, whew, I'm out of breath. I don't know about you, but there is a lot in the membership. And as I mentioned at the top of the podcast, this really is my passion. And this is something that I am giving myself to over the next decade or so. Where we start today, and there's an awful lot in there already, certainly will not be where we end up. And I'd love to have you along with me on the journey. So as ever, I will include a link in the description associated with this podcast if you are interested in finding out more and also looking at which level of membership might be right for you. And for those of you already out there who are already members of TUG, I just want to say a massive thank you for coming on board from the beginning. Many of you are founder members and helped me test out the site, and I am deeply grateful. And I just love the community that we are building. So, my friends, maybe I'll see you there. Okay, well, with all that housekeeping done, we are ready to get on with the meat of today's show. And yes, I am whisking you off to the ancient city of Winchester in Hampshire, which is down towards the south coast of England, if you're not entirely familiar with the geography. Now, Winchester is such a fascinating place because its history stretches way, way back. It is replete with Roman history, with Saxon history, and of course with medieval and Tudor history. You can really spend a full weekend enjoying all its historic delights. But the centrepiece has to be, of course, its great medieval cathedral. And that is where we are going today. So let us not tarry any further. It's time to meet our expert guide and to hear all about the Tudor tales associated with Winchester Cathedral. And yes, there are a couple of very important Tudor events linked to it. So, my friends, I give you Winchester Cathedral and our guide, Aisha El-Saidi. Well, welcome, dear listeners. You find me in the centre of the ancient city of Winchester, right outside its venerable cathedral. And as I said in the introduction, I wanted to come here because this city has a long and noble history, which reaches way back in time. And we're going to be exploring a little bit of that in a moment with our guide. But with regards to Tudor history, there are also a couple of really important events and visitors to Winchester that I wanted to highlight in this podcast. We have the visit of Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn in 1535 during their historic summer progress. And then, of course, we have the marriage of Mary I to Philip. And we're going to be going into some detail about each of those events and where they took place and standing in the very places that they unfolded. So, buckle up because we're about to go on an adventure in time. And to do that, we need a guide. So I'm going to introduce Aisha. Hello, Aisha. Thank you so much for being here today.
Hi, Sarah. So nice to see you today.
It's a bit of a chilly day, chilly January day that we're recording this, but thankfully no snow.
No snow.
And no snow. But maybe before we start our story, you could just tell us who you are. What do you do here at the cathedral?
So my name is Aisha El-Saidi and I am the Learning and Heritage Officer here at the cathedral. So that is kind of the doesn't really describe exactly what I do. But when we have school children who want to come and learn about the cathedral and the history of Winchester, as well as looking at art and science and all the faith that we can look at in the building, then that's what I do. So I design a day for them. Uh-huh. And I also am essentially the assistant curator as well, so I get to look and touch and look after all the amazing old objects that we have in the cathedral with our curator and librarian.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, well, I don't know whether we'll be lucky enough to see any of those today, but we are going to be talking about the history, as I said, and going into the cathedral and standing in some of the really important places there. Before we dive into the Tudor history that I was mentioning earlier, I think it is worthwhile talking about the very ancient roots of Winchester because it was an incredibly important city and it's way back, way back, even before the Norman invasion. Mm-hmm. Maybe we could start there. Tell us a little bit about the history of Winchester and how come it became so important.
It's a very good question. Essentially, we had an Iron Age fort here, populated by a group of Britons called the Belgae tribe. And then from then, we had the Romans turning up in this part of Britain, and they created an amazing city here called Venta Belgarum. And where our current cathedral is at the moment, we think there was some sort of forum or some sort of important site here. Then the Romans left, and then we had the Angles, the Saxons and the Jutes turning up, collectively being known as the Anglo-Saxons. And then in the early 600s, we had our first minster built in Winchester. And that was really important because it would have looked completely different from every other building in Winchester, because it was the first stone building to be built here since the Romans left.
Wow.
And it would have been quite a simple building. But as I say, it would have stood out from all the mottled and daub houses that would have been surrounding it.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
What is a minster as opposed to a cathedral?
So a minster is basically a church, is what a minster is. And we had not only the Old Minster, which was the first one to be built in 648, but we also had the New Minster, which was built in 901 AD. And that was a Benedictine abbey that became a royal mausoleum, so where the royal family of Winchester was buried.
Thank you for saying that, because the royal connection is really important. Mm-hmm. I think perhaps people who don't know so much about English history might mistake the fact that London has always been England's capital, but of course it wasn't like that. And maybe you could explain why that was so, and what was so important about Winchester.
Yes, absolutely. So Winchester was never the capital city of England, but it was the capital city of the Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Wessex. So if you think at the time, especially time of King Alfred, which everybody's heard of, there were many different kingdoms in England. So it wasn't, England didn't exist as one country. It was lots and lots of different kingdoms. And Wessex was a very, very important kingdom. It was one of the largest ones. And it was the last one when we had the Great Heathen, or the Great Summer Army of Vikings, taking over Anglo-Saxon England. Wessex was the last kingdom, which is where you get the programme The Last Kingdom from, okay. Bernard Cornwell books. So Wessex was the last kingdom before the Vikings came and eventually got that back. They took it over from Alfred, but then Alfred won it back again. But Winchester was really important because it's where the Royal Mint was. We had a royal palace here as well.
And it was huge, that palace, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely stunning. And the Old Minster went from being quite a humble, simple minster to becoming a really extravagant one. Lots of extensions were put on, towers were put on to it. And then when you had the New Minster, they competed with each other. Uh-huh. So they made themselves grander and grander. And they would have been absolutely amazing buildings to see.
Yeah, but those minsters no longer exist. We're standing in front of a later building. And so how did that happen? What happened to the old minsters, and how come we have this magnificent building? And by the way, I should just say, dear listeners, as ever, there will be a show notes page associated with this podcast. We'll be taking lots of pictures. So if you want to refer to that show notes page, there'll be a link in the description associated with the podcast, as ever. So you can look at the pictures and hear Aisha and I chat as we go. So yes, the question was, what happened to the old minsters, and what is this building in front of us?
So when the Norman Conquest happened in 1066, and William the Conqueror came to Winchester, he saw the amazing old and new minsters, and obviously with a lot of the things that the Normans did, they wanted to put their stamp on it. They wanted to say, well, we're not scrubbing away the history, because we want to say that we own that now, but equally we want to say that this is ours. So they knocked down the old minster and they built this great big whacking Norman cathedral on top of it, well, just to the north of it. And it's absolutely huge. It's much, much bigger than the old or the new minster was. And a lot of the stone from the old minster was used in the construction of the current cathedral.
Makes a lot of sense. Can you give us any stats, any dimension, just to give people an idea maybe of how big the cathedral is?
It's very big. The children ask us that a lot. I can't remember off the top of my head, but I know that it's big. When it was originally built, because it's had modifications done to the front of it, so we had some Gothic medieval style reconstruction to the nave and the front of the cathedral. So the cathedral actually would have been, the nave of the cathedral would have been much longer when it was originally built, and we had the largest medieval nave in Europe. We still say that, I think, to some extent, but I don't know if that's really true. Of the UK anyway. But certainly when it was built, it was one of the largest buildings to ever exist.
And what's the date of this Norman cathedral?
So we say 1078, 1079. And yeah, it's been here for nearly 1,000 years
yeah,
now.
Yeah, it always blows my mind. There's nothing like stepping into a building that's over 1,000 years old to give you some goosebumps. So what we're going to do in a minute, I think, is go inside. And I would just say to those folk listening that it is a normal opening day in the cathedral. There will be life will be going on. So as usual, you may hear some noises in the background, but hopefully that will just add to your sense of being here alongside us. Now, before we go inside the cathedral and start talking about the Tudor, couple of Tudor events that I mentioned at the top of the programme, I really wanted to ask you about the legend of St Swithin, because many people who know anything about Winchester will know about St Swithin and the old 40 rainy days. Can you just clarify, who was St Swithin and what's in this legend? How did that come about?
So St Swithin, he was originally an Anglo-Saxon bishop of the Old Minster, so he was Bishop Swithin, and he performed lots of miracles during his life. You might have heard of the miracle of the lady with the basket of eggs on the Winchester Bridge, mm-hmm. where he helped her and made her eggs whole again so she was able to feed her family. So there are lots and lots of legends and stories around about St Swithin when he was alive, and when he died and he became a saint, lots of people came on pilgrimage to Winchester to kneel at the tomb of St Swithin and claimed to be healed. So all the walls of the Old Minster was covered in the crutches of people who had come to the shrine and been healed. And eventually he was moved from outside the cathedral because outside the Old Minster, he said, I don't want a grand tomb. I'm quite a humble man. I want people to be able to see me. But they decided, well, actually, he's bringing quite a lot of pilgrims. So we want to move him in so we can make some money out of it, really. So they moved him into the actual minster itself. And when they moved him in, they had a special service. They did it all with a lot of pageantry, and a special silver box was made to contain his bones. And it's said that when the men carrying the box, the reliquary box, stepped over the threshold into the Old Minster, that it went from being a very sunny day to being a very dark day, and the ground was covered with ice, and it rained for 40 days and 40 nights because they went against the wishes.
He was not a happy man.
He was not happy.
Right, no, okay. No. And hence so. And it's funny, actually, because I was reading a little bit about that legend, and it's something about it. What time of year is it? Is it July?
Yes, July the 15th.
There's actually some meteorological event around that time, I think, that means actually if it does rain, it will rain for that length of time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, interesting. Anyway, I prefer the first version myself. It's got a little bit more mystique to it. Yeah. A bit more drama.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Well, why don't we go inside and we can perhaps talk about our first story, which is the 1535 visit of Anne Boleyn and Henry VIII and why they came here to Winchester and in particular to this cathedral.
Fabulous.
Let's go then.
Let's go.
Well, we've come inside and I'm very glad for it. I don't know about you, Aisha, but my fingers are like icicles.
It's actually warmer in here, which I hardly ever is.
Well, we are standing at the west end of the church, just inside the Great West Doors, looking down the nave, and wow, what a sight. Maybe you could just start by describing a little about what we're seeing and the architecture. What kind of architecture is it?
So the immediate thing that you're struck by when you come into the west end of the cathedral is the grand scale of it and how high the ceiling is. So whenever I bring school children in here, everybody goes, wow, because it's just so beautiful. So we've got these lovely, slim, Gothic columns going all the way up to a ribbed Gothic ceiling. They're actually covering the really thick Norman columns that are inside them, but they made them look really, really slender by putting these Gothic ones over the top of them. Mm. And when you look right up at the ceiling, you can see we've got all sorts of different roof bosses, so different symbols. We've also got different grotesques, little animal faces, little people faces, little sort of creatures sort of poking out of all the different parts of the architecture. And we've got a lot of uplighting in the cathedral as well, these beautiful lights.
Lighting is everything, I find.
It absolutely transforms the space.
Yeah.
And you notice so much about the architecture that you wouldn't have seen. And especially at this time of the year as well, because it's quite dim in the cathedral, it's quite dark. Mm. You notice things in this lighting more than you would at any other time of year. And it's just really amazing.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Now, the first event that I wanted to talk about was the arrival of Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn to Winchester in the summer of 1535. It's a progress very dear to my heart. I've written quite a lot about it. And that's really why I wanted to come here, because it's almost the centrepiece of that progress was coming to Winchester, because there was a big event going on. So maybe you could tell us, first of all, about that event. Why here?
So Winchester, being as important as it was throughout history in terms of William the Conqueror, in terms of the Anglo-Saxons as well, King Alfred, I think the main thing was that Henry wanted to say, I am part of this line, I am part of this dynasty, and I am important as well. And with this place being as long as it has, you know, it survived all the turmoil and things that were going on at the time. I think it was his way of saying, you know, look, I am part of this as well. So yeah. Being able to come to this amazing building and carry on that story, but putting his name on it, I think was quite a powerful move, really.
Yeah, so a centrepiece, a showpiece, because this was, obviously, there was a huge amount of turmoil around his marriage to Anne Boleyn and what was unfolding with the church, what had unfolded on the back of the King's Great Matter and the annulment of the marriage to Catherine. And very much that 1535 progress was about honouring many courtiers who'd been supportive of a marriage to Anne.
Absolutely.
And of course, we have her three reformist bishops that were going to be consecrated here. So what you're saying is it was such an important historic site, which had those really deep roots in history, that it was worthy of such a grand event.
Yes, yeah, I think so. I think it was his way of saying, you know, this building, this cathedral, this history has survived time, as it were. It's an immortal sort of being in itself, and he's sort of taking a little bit of that cake, as it were, and being like, I'm going to have a piece of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And so perhaps you could tell us about the men, the bishops themselves. Who were they? What do we know about them?
Yeah, so it was such an important occasion, because for the first time, the appointing of these English bishops was a grand ceremony. So this was because Pope Paul III outraged after hearing that Henry had executed John Fisher, who the Pope had just made a cardinal, excommunicated Henry and England. So this meant that Henry was able to appoint whoever he wanted and conduct the day without interference from Rome. So he was able to have his party without anybody saying to him,
which is a real big up yours to Rome, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Hugely.
Absolutely.
So I think it's appropriate to ask, who were these three men?
So they were Edward Fox, Hugh Latimer, and John Hillesley. So they were the ones that, I mean, this was their day, basically.
But they weren't being made Bishop of Winchester.
No.
They were being bishops of different places. So who was who and what was going on there?
So we had Edward Fox, who became Bishop of Hereford, Hugh Latimer, who became Bishop of Worcester, and John Hillesley was Bishop of Rochester.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, they were all Anne's men. They were all reformish bishops.
She was helping out her pals, basically. She was saying thank you, wasn't she? She was, here's a cushy job and lots of power and money, because it was a big deal to be made a bishop of anywhere.
What can you tell us about that? What kind of privileges and benefits came from becoming a bishop?
Well, lots of bishops that we have throughout history, they're not just ordinary people. Like we have now, you know, you train to become a member of clergy, you become a priest, and you eventually possibly become a bishop. These were people who were connected. So they were either members of the royal family themselves, so directly related to the royal family, or in the case of some of these men, they were already people of privilege, already people of money, people of power, and they just happened to be on the right side at the right time and are rewarded for this. So not necessarily the most Christian of people. A lot of them didn't actually take their jobs all that seriously.
Oh, is that right?
And so we have what we call an absent bishop in some parts of our history, where you have a bishop who is a bishop in everything, in name, but not in practice. Not in practice, yes.
Okay, but enjoying all the rewards and the status and the privilege
Absolutely.
Of being in that position.
Swathes and swathes of land, huge, huge estates, buildings, people encompassing that. I mean, essentially lords of their own little kingdoms, really.
Mm. So maybe back to the ceremony of this consecration. When did this happen? What date was it?
So it was on September the 11th, 1535.
And obviously Henry and Anne had come here. They'd wound their way through Oxfordshire and Gloucestershire and now through into Hampshire. And do we know where they stayed? And maybe some of the details. Do we know anything about actually what happened during that consecration service?
We do know a bit about what happened on the day, who was there and where it took place. Historians believe it's likely that Henry and Anne were at the service itself, but we don't know any further details.
Mm.
It's likely that the service itself would have taken place at the high altar, which is just behind where we're standing.
So we've kind of come right the way up the nave, haven't we? And we are in the choir at the moment, just in front of the high altar. And yes, I mean, you would imagine, wouldn't you, that the king and queen would have the privileged place right in front of where all the action was happening. So this is absolutely gorgeous. Can you tell us about this high altar? Because there's a stunning array of carved figures, such intricate carving. How old is this?
So the great screen, which is the architectural point that you're pointing out. So the screen itself, the actual division of the area that we're standing in called the presbytery, which is right in the middle of the cross shape of the cathedral. So
right.
The cathedral's in the shape of a cross.
Yeah.
Presbytery is right in the middle. And this would have been a really special private place that only the Benedictine monks from the Priory of St. Swithin would have been allowed to come into. So normal people like you and me, especially women, would not have been allowed in here.
Yeah, right.
And this screen was built to separate the presbytery from the area where St. Swithin's bones were kept. And this amazing stone figures that you see in the great screen are not the original. So they would have been very highly decorated, they would have been very colourful, and we think they would have been very similar in that they would have shown, God, Jesus, saints, but they were all destroyed during the Reformation.
So is the screen itself mm-hmm. original, but the figures have been replaced later? Is that what you're saying?
The screen itself is medieval, so it's not as old as the Norman part of the cathedral.
Right.
Whenever you look into the history of this building, you'll notice that things have changed over time. We've had extensions added, we've had new bits added over time. So we think the screen is about 13th, 14th century, but the figures are in the screen itself are Victorian.
Right. Yeah, but it's absolutely stunning, isn't it? Thank you for that. So behind that, we've got what was the shrine of St. Swithin, and post-Reformation, of course.
Yes.
That got destroyed, right?
Yes, absolutely, yes. So his bones were brought from the Old Minster. They were put behind this screen on a special platform, and pilgrims would crawl through a hole to be able to walk past the bones of St. Swithin. And then a special shrine was made into the retrochoir, which is a later medieval extension onto the back of the cathedral, onto the east end. And that's where we had the shrine, but that was destroyed. And we don't know what happened to the bones of St. Swithin.
Oh, that's so sad, isn't it? Speaking of bones, though, before we return to our story of Anne and Henry right here by the high altar, one of the lovely things I think you have are these, like, reliquary boxes of bones of the old Anglo-Saxon kings and queens. Is that right? Is that, because I want to point that out in case people come here and they're standing in front of the high altar. If you look up to your left and your right, you'll see these kind of painted boxes. Tell us about them. I think they're fascinating.
So we have six mortuary chests in the presbytery in the middle of the cathedral, and three on one side of the screen and three on the other side. The boxes themselves are Tudor, so they're not Anglo-Saxon boxes. We know that we at least had another set, an earlier set of boxes, but obviously because of their wood, they disintegrate over time. So these are Tudor boxes. So very old, but not as old as some of the other things we have in the cathedral.
Still Tudor, though.
Still Tudor, though. Yeah, still really important. But the bones inside are much, much older. So we think they are the bones of 23 different people, all jumbled up together. And they were people who were originally buried in the Anglo-Saxon Old Minster and New Minster. So Anglo-Saxon kings and queens of Wessex.
Right.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And I think that's pretty unique. I've never seen these, and there may be other places, but I've never seen them. This is the place that it stands out for me as having these just unique features.
Absolutely. And King Alfred, unfortunately, he was buried in the New Minster, but then a special abbey was made for him called Hyde Abbey, just outside Winchester, and his bones and his family's bones were going to all be buried there, but then Hyde Abbey was destroyed during the Reformation, and so King Alfred's bones are lost. So they are not here in the mortuary chests.
I bet a few people have tried to find him, though, haven't they?
Yeah. Well, they did. They think that they did find him at one point, but it was when it used to be sort of a prison area, and we don't know what happened. But we do have the bones of really significant kings and queens. So if you've ever heard of King Canute, the Viking who became an Anglo-Saxon king, and his Norman wife, Queen Emma, really important in modern royal family as well. Yeah. Really important people in the history of England.
Brilliant. Well, why don't we just take a little stroll, just right up to the steps of the high altar, where all the action would have happened back in September 1535. So I guess somewhere near here, we have Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn seated, listening to all that's going on. What would have happened during a consecration ceremony?
It's a very good question. I've never seen one. But I think it's important to remember that I believe from what I've read and our current thinking of Henry and who he was, is that he was a Catholic at heart, really. And the country was still Catholic, even though Anne Boleyn had all these ideas. And you know, I have quite a lot of sympathy for Anne. I think actually she was quite forward thinking in all the things that she thought. But to move away from this idea of Catholicism and Rome and all the things that made Christianity what it was and all the sacredness that came from that, I think would have still been very evident at the service. So that it still would have been a proper service as we know it today. So even though, you know, we'd have a change of faces, I still think that there still would have been a lot of things about the service that would have been recognisable to the people there. So I don't think it was a case of he wanted to change things and it changed that day.
Right.
I think it would have still been a recognisable service to people who had been to a similar service.
Now, when I was researching this particular progress, I'm not sure we know exactly where Anne and Henry stayed, but we figured that they probably stayed in the bishop's palace. It seemed the most logical thing. I imagine after a service like that, there would have been probably some feasting and some celebration, I imagine, back at the palace. Do we have any records here in the cathedral relating to that day or what happened?
We don't in the cathedral itself, but I think Hampshire Archive Office might have something about what happened here at the cathedral, but we don't have any evidence or any detail or even any objects really from this event. And it's such an important event, and it's almost like it didn't happen.
I know, that is bizarre, isn't it? Because you would have thought that somewhere in some great dusty book
there would be a record of something. I haven't found anything. I might find something at some point.
Keep looking, won't you?
Yeah,
absolutely. Okay, so unfortunately, no objects for us to see. But if we come on to our second Tudor event, which is a different event, a marriage between, of course, Mary I and her Spanish king, Philip II of Spain. I suppose the first question that, when I was first learning about Tudor history, and was why here? Mm. Why didn't Philip go to London? What was going on there?
Well, I think one of the main points is that people of England weren't very happy about the marriage. So they were worried that England would become subject to Spain. And so there was a lot of rioting in London. So I think the idea was that they were just going to quickly ship him up from Southampton, get him into Winchester and have the wedding, essentially. Right, yeah. I think it's how
just
it worked.
Slip it under the carpet.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nothing to see here.
Not to say that it wasn't a grand occasion, because it absolutely was. But I think Winchester was a little bit more amenable and a little bit smaller than London. And
yeah, okay. So remind me, what was the date of the wedding? When did all this festivity happen?
So it was the 25th of July, 1554.
Lovely summer, hopefully. Lovely summer day, I hope. So Philip obviously is arriving from Spain, so he'll be coming up from the south coast, meeting Mary, who's coming down from London. What do we know about the time in Winchester before the wedding took place?
So yes, absolutely. He travelled up from the port of Southampton, and when he got to Winchester itself, he went straight to the cathedral, like a good boy, to pray, and great songs of thanksgiving were sung by the choir.
I mean, literally where we're standing.
Literally where we're standing.
He must have been here. Yep. He must have knelt right in front of the high altar by this step. That's cool. I've just had that shiver feeling up and down my spine. Wow, carry on.
But it was 2 days before the wedding, on the 23rd of July, that they met. So Mary and Philip actually met for the first time at Wolvesey Castle and that evening, and they had a feast together.
Well, you would do.
Well, you would, yeah. Got to impress your new wife, I suppose. So they were lodged in two different places. So Mary stayed at Wolvesey Castle and Philip stayed at the deanery here within the grounds of the cathedral.
And from where you're talking, I'm imagining the deanery actually still exists.
Yes, it does. Yeah, absolutely. It's an amazing building with three arches out the front of it, but it's still a private residence. It's still where our dean currently lives. It's always been a deanery.
That's great. Has it been changed in the interior, or is the room layout pretty much as it was, do you know?
So Prior's Hall, which makes up one half of the building, was a medieval hall, and it still is when you go up to the second floor, but it would have been one open space with the beams on the top. But it was altered during a visit by King Charles, and so it looks very...
As in King Charles the First, Second?
I think it's second. Don't quote me on that.
Not
I can't
the
quite
current
remember.
King Charles.
Not the current king. Of course, yeah, not the current one. But yes, it doesn't look medieval in there at all. At the moment, we've got lots of plaster work and two floors were made. And in the deanery itself, it looks like a home because it's somebody's been living there for a long time.
That's great.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's forward to the wedding day. What do we know about that day? Do you have any records? Again, we were talking about records before, that you don't have anything about the service of consecration of the Reformist bishops. Is that the same for the wedding of Mary and Philip?
So we know a little bit more about Mary's wedding. We know that a temporary wooden walkway and dais was built all along the length of the nave, so kind of like a catwalk.
Yeah.
With a red carpet running all the way along, so everybody could see her as she walked down the nave for her wedding. And the cathedral itself was decorated, they say, with cloths of gold. So when you go into the nave, you can see there are little metal hooks all the way along the columns, and that's where they think we had all these draperies hanging down. We also know that on the temporary dais, the Queen's chair was on the right-hand side and Philip's was on the left. Mm-hmm. And that was really significant because it meant that Mary was walking on Philip's right because she was sovereign. Mm-hmm. So traditionally, it would have been the other way around. So it was showing that even though she was marrying Philip, she was the Queen, which was really, really important. So Bishop Gardiner officiated the wedding, our Bishop of the Cathedral.
Wow, right. And he's buried here, isn't he?
He is, yes. He has a chantry chapel.
Well, maybe in a moment we could go around and have a look at that tomb. That would be great. So once again, I'm seeing the walkway spanning right the way down from the west doors, coming right at me to here in front of the high altar where it all happened. Now, I know before, when we were talking about arranging this, you were talking about Mary's wedding dress, because we know something about that, don't we?
We absolutely do. We know what they both wore. So Philip wore an embroidered suit of cloth of gold, which always sounds nice, isn't it? Cloth of gold.
Shimmering.
Yeah, and Mary wore a gown of rich tissue with a border and wide sleeves embroidered upon purple satin, set with pearls of our store lined with purple taffeta.
Lovely, gorgeous. And I've seen a replica of that dress somewhere.
Yes, it's mine.
Is it yours?
Yeah.
So tell me, how did you get it? I mean, was that just a passion project of yours?
Pretty much. So the marriage of Mary and Philip here isn't really one that we talk about all that much. And I was never really quite sure why, because it's such an amazing story, you know, and it's one of our claims to fame that this great, amazing ceremony happened here.
Yeah.
And so myself and now Dr. Joanna created a series last year for the cathedral, so it's on our YouTube channel, all about the wedding here at the cathedral. And for that, I asked my friend Fiona Green to make me an amazing replica costume, replica dress, based on portraits of Mary from the wedding.
Yes, because there are portraits of Philip and Mary together. Is one of them a wedding portrait then?
Yes, yeah. So one of them, you can see the purple dress.
Ah, well, we'll try and dig that out and perhaps we can put that on the show notes page so people can see that. And do you have a photograph of the dress that we might be able
absolutely.
To also share with people who are listening? Because that would be lovely. Now, the big question is, Aisha, did you wear it?
I did wear it, yes. And absolutely, I did. Absolutely. At any opportunity given, yes, I was wearing it, yes. Yeah, I still have it. It's mine. I paid for it. So, yeah, it's just sort of sitting there in the cupboard whenever I feel like dressing up as Mary.
Oh,
you know?
That seems a shame. Yeah. You need to find some other places to get out and about and wear that dress. That's wonderful. Is there anything else we need to know about that the day itself? You said that Gardner officiated, and we will go and talk about Gardner in a moment, but anything else we need to know about the day?
So after the wedding took place in the nave, so that's in the main sort of corridor of the cathedral, they then would have come into the presbytery of the cathedral, where we're standing now, right in the middle, which would have been sectioned off from everybody else. The nave was a public space, but the presbytery isn't. And they would have knelt up here at the high altar and they would have had a service of Mass. So they still would have had the Catholic Mass service said. Mary was Catholic, Philip was Catholic. So even after everything that King Henry VIII did, her dad, she wanted a Catholic Mass here for her wedding.
So they got married in the public space in the nave, but then came into the private space to hear Mass. That's really interesting. Yeah. So that's really important for people who are visiting, because I think it could be easy to think that they got married here in front of the high altar, but actually it was in a different space. So thank you very much for pointing that out. Interested in the chair. May I bring up the chair? Because anybody who loves Tudor history and has been on the internet at any point looking at this will have seen this X-framed chair that's in a pretty bad state. And the claim is it was used by, I think, Mary during that ceremony. Is it the real thing is what I'm asking you?
We don't really know. It's a lovely story, but there's no evidence to prove it either or disagree with it either way. So we aren't sure if it is the real chair or not. We do know that it is a beautiful, very old chair that hasn't seen the best of days, and we are hoping to have some research done on it for it to be conserved at some point in the future, and then hopefully we will be able to say either way whether it is the real chair or not.
Yes, because I suppose you can get the wood dated for instance. Yep. I guess.
Yeah, or the fabrics or the style, well. But we need a specialist to come in and have a look at it.
Yeah. Can you just describe it? I said it's X-frame, mm-hmm. but what can you just describe what's there currently?
Yeah, so it does have a seat pad on it. Whether that's original or not, we're not sure. And there's sort of like a gold circular shape at the bottom of it with almost like flower pattern on it. Yeah. I'm not quite sure what the significance of that is, but it's quite a simple looking chair. There were many of them around at that time. It was quite a simple design for a chair. Yeah. So whether it's the real one or not, we will hopefully find out.
Well, we're going to have to stay tuned, aren't we?
We are.
And follow this story with interest. But yes. Yes, you would have to be careful when one lays claim to things like that.
Absolutely.
Until we have the evidence. Yeah. So, an intriguing story.
Yes.
So, before we leave the presbytery and perhaps go and see Bishop Gardiner and his chantry tomb, I can't help but notice some of the other architectural features. And the thing that really catches my eye in here are all the bosses on the ceiling, these beautiful coloured carved bosses. And in particular, there seems to be a lot of Tudor iconography. I can see an HR, I can see a royal coat of arms next to it, I can see a Beaufort portcullis and a Tudor rose. Why are they up there? Is there any particular... Which Henry we're talking about for a start?
Yes.
And why are they up there?
So this is King Henry VII. So the HR is Henry Rex, so King Henry. And the roof bosses, when you look at them from down here, they look really small, but they're actually about 6 foot. They are massive and they are solid wood. And the gold that you see is actual real gold leaf. So they shine and shimmer and they're absolutely beautiful. And they're essentially there, apart from looking nice, to hide all the nuts and bolts that hold the wooden roof together. So when you look down towards the nave, you can see that we have a stone version of the wooden one above you. So we have the stone Gothic ribbed roof. But when Bishop Fox was redoing the cathedral into this Gothic style, he wanted this part of the cathedral roof to be stone as well, but they had already changed the pillars in the presbytery from the really thick, sturdy Norman pillars into these thin Purbeck marble pillars, so they couldn't hold a stone roof. So he had to find a way of making it in keeping with the rest of the cathedral. I think he did quite a good job.
So Bishop Fox was when? I mean, if it's Henry, or if it was talking about the turn of the 16th century, somewhere around there.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, 1500.
So that roof above us is of that date. Mm-hmm. It's sort of the turn of the 16th century, yep. And all of those bosses are of that period?
Yep. So they've been recently conserved, so they look really bright and beautiful.
Yeah,
but they've been up there for all of that time.
Wow.
And when you look at, in particular, the fact that you've got the Henry crest up there, you have a rose bush and a crown on top of the rose bush. So we think that that harks back to the Battle of Bosworth and his claim to the throne. And we've got different badges of his ancestors promoting both him and his son, later Henry VIII, and his future wife Catherine of Aragon as well. So it's basically Henry VII's way of saying, look how great I am, and I've put my stamp on the cathedral, basically.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
Because I can see so many. I can see the greyhound, and I think that's the Welsh dragon.
Yes.
You could spend ages looking and just picking out different symbols. I haven't seen the Catherine of Aragon pomegranate, but maybe that gives me something to
come and have a look at.
I love the three dice. So I'm not sure what they're supposed to represent. So gambling, maybe.
I hope not. We have lots of coats of arms and different symbols for different families. And the pelicans that you can see, there are gold pelicans everywhere, and they are the symbols of Bishop Fox. So when you see a pelican in the cathedral, it's Bishop Fox.
Yeah. Excellent. The guy basically who did that roof.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you for that. That's marvellous. So much to see in here. We've spent a good half an hour just having a look around. It's wonderful. Now, I'd love to go and see Bishop Gardiner, who is quite... quite an interesting figure.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because he started to come to power, well, his star started to rise, shall we say, I think during the reign of Henry VIII. And he was originally on the good side of Henry VIII. And then I think he prevaricated a bit over the whole Anne Boleyn thing. And Henry wasn't that happy with him. But of course, when Mary, he was a Catholic at heart, right?
He was, yes.
Tell us
yes.
a little bit about him. Actually, let's go around.
Let's go and have a look at him.
Let's go and have a look at him. Lead the way. Because anybody who knows me, who follows the Tudor Travel Guide, will know I love tombs. So yes. This is slightly macabre side of me. And is this one of these Mentimentamari tombs? Am I remembering the right one?
Oh, a cadaver.
Yeah, a cadaver mm-hmm. tomb. Yeah. yeah. Oh, here we are.
Here he is.
Here he is. So maybe we should just start by describing
yes.
what's in front of us.
Yes.
I'm standing in front of a huge it's carved in stone, memorial. There seems to be like a chapel above, and then below you have this iron grill with what is clearly a rotting cadaver, which was very fashionable in the time. Mm-hmm. Is the whole thing, is that chantry chapel of Stephen Gardiner, is yes. the whole thing Gardiner's?
So yes, so that whole structure is his. But interestingly, even though we have a sign that says it's a chantry chapel, it technically isn't, because at the time that he was buried, they were illegal.
Aha, uh-huh. Interesting.
So it's not technically a chantry chapel, but it is, if that makes sense.
What would you have called it at the time then, if it wasn't a chantry chapel, or were they just not named?
Yeah, I'm not sure what they would have called them, but a chantry chapel is Catholic,
yes,
and
indeed.
England wasn't Catholic at that point, yeah. at the point that he died, so we still call it his chantry chapel, but it technically isn't.
Yeah.
But yeah, and there are all sorts of speculations as to why his head has been decapitated as well. So in this
yes, so should we
cadaver,
just say that the cadaver, yes, the head has been cut
yeah.
off.
Yeah.
So what's the story there?
There are lots of theories, as there is about anywhere this old, and that there aren't really any written records, and people make a good guess as to what they think might have happened. We think it could have been after the Reformation. We think it could have been if somebody wasn't maybe his biggest fan. We're not really sure. But damage was done to the cathedral several times throughout its history, during the Civil War as well. So we're not entirely sure when exactly it happened.
Mm.
But that's the first thing that people notice is, well, obviously that it looks like a rotting body. It looks like a skeleton or somebody who's decomposing, but also that his head has been quite clearly sliced.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, since we're here, we've started with talking about the poor man in death, but maybe we should talk about him in life. I introduced him, my vague memory of who Bishop Stephen Gardiner is, but maybe you could tell us a little bit about him and why he was officiating at the wedding.
Well, he was Catholic, as we said. Well, we think he had Catholic sympathies, and Mary reinstated him. So if I believe that he was imprisoned at least a couple of times in his life at the Tower of London, because England went from being Catholic to Protestant and Catholic to Protestant again. And so depending on who was on the throne, he was either their best friend or their worst enemy. Obviously, Mary liked him, otherwise she wouldn't have asked for him to officiate their wedding.
Yeah, and there's very helpfully a plaque below that tells us exactly that he was Bishop of Winchester between 1531 and 1551, and then again between 1553 and 1555. But Chancellor of England between 1553 and 1555, which is obviously relating to Mary's period of Mary's reign, or part of period of Mary's
Absolutely.
Reign.
Which goes back to what we were saying earlier on about the fact that if you were a bishop, you had other responsibilities and other roles, and you weren't just an ordinary person.
Right.
You would have had a role in court as well, and you would have been somebody of power and significance. So
yeah.
being bishop of the cathedral wasn't just a one-stop shop. You were King's Secretary or Chancellor of England or whatever it was that
yeah.
the monarch wanted you to be, essentially.
Brilliant. So, having looked at this amazing chantry chapel, I'd really love to just go around the corner, because that's, as you were pointing out before, behind the high altar, you have what was once, I suppose, really a sacred heart of the cathedral, with the bones of St. Swithin and where all the pilgrims would have come.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the original shrine is gone, right?
It is, yes, unfortunately.
maybe you could tell us, of course, some people, of course, will understand why immediately, but maybe you could tell us why this shrine is no longer here.
Yeah, absolutely. So during the Reformation, it was sort of decided that praying to the bones of dead saints wasn't a very Christian thing to do, or to idolise different saints or pictures or statues, and that you should have direct communication with God, so mm-hmm. through prayer rather than to an object, if that makes sense. Mm. And so the Shrine of St Swithin, where you can currently see a shrine marker, so it's a metal structure in the retrochoir, which is in the east of the cathedral. And that shows where the shrine would have originally been. And it would have been made of stone, and it would have had little niches in for people to kneel into and to be able to speak to the bones of St Swithin. And the idea was that he would help to send their prayers up to heaven. So that was the idea. And it would have had a canopy of cloth, of red cloth above the shrine. And it would have been a thing of beauty. Mm. And it would have been a very, very busy place yeah. in the cathedral.
Yes, absolutely. I thought it might be interesting just to highlight one or two of the other real special features about mm. Winchester. And beyond the high altar, you find this fabulous tiled floor. It's clearly very old. Can you tell us about it?
Yes, so it's the largest and most expansive medieval tile pavement or carpet in Western Europe. It's 13th century. And it's absolutely beautiful. It's a very interesting relationship that we have in the cathedral with old objects. Mm-hmm. In that if we were purely a museum which just looked after the old objects we had here, this tile pavement would have been removed a long time ago. Yeah. And nobody would be allowed to breathe on it, touch it, anything.
Yeah, right.
But because it's in this sacred space and it was made for this sacred space, people are still allowed to walk on these tiles. And you can see that they've actually started to deteriorate quite badly. And so we are now looking at ways that we can conserve the tiles as best we can and how we do that without meaning that people don't have access to this
eastern
part of the cathedral.
It's a challenge, isn't it?
It's a real challenge.
Because you get a lot of visitors, so yeah. You know, a lot of wear and tear
absolutely.
On these tiles.
Absolutely.
Do they mean it? I mean, obviously, I can see fleur-de-lis yep. patterns.
Yes.
I can see just like simple daisy patterns. A light, maybe a griffin or something
yes,
over
we've got
here?
Yes, griffins, yep, symbol of Jesus, yeah.
Oh, okay, so that's what I was going to ask you.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know, what do they mean, some of these patterns that we see?
Absolutely. So, again, with all of these things, it's speculation, isn't it? We have experts who come in and give their opinions, and other people have different opinions. But I think the biggest thing to remember is that these would have meant something to the pilgrims that came to the Shrine of St Swithin, and they would have reminded them of different Christian teachings and beliefs. So absolutely, that when we have children in, I say to them, well, what star do you think of when you think of Christian stories? And obviously they say the Star of Bethlehem. So we have a six-pointed star, which I say is the Star of Bethlehem. Mm-hmm. We have flowers, which could be a symbol of creation. Fleur-de-lis is actually a symbol of Mary. So that's one of her symbols. So it's a lily. So lily is a symbol of Mary. Griffin is a symbol of Jesus. And it goes on and on and on. We also have ones with triangles on, yes, which we think are the Trinity because it's 3 points.
Ah, yes, I see. It's so clever. Honestly, the medieval and Tudor folk, there were symbols in everything.
Everything.
If only you know. And so much of that language has been lost to us now, hasn't it?
Absolutely. But in the building of the cathedral as well, the sacred geometry and the methods that were used to make this building, it's just amazing.
And the other feature that you cannot fail to be impressed by when you come to Winchester is the chantry chapels. And we've already talked about Stephen Gardiner and his chantry chapel. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are, just in front of me here we are, right at the east end of the church. I can see four, if we count Gardiner's.
Yes.
Magnificent chantry chapels, maybe even more over here. I mean, can you tell us a little bit about some of the characters and why they have chantry chapels here?
So the idea of a chantry chapel was that your soul could quickly leave purgatory and go to heaven. So if you were somebody such as Cardinal Beaufort, who we're standing in front of, he would have left money for his chantry to be built, hopefully before he passed away, and also left money to the monks, the Benedictine monks here at the Prior of St. Swithin, to go into his chantry chapel every day and say Mass at the special altar in his chantry chapel. And the idea was that these prayers would help to speed his soul from purgatory to heaven, because you didn't want to stay in purgatory.
Yeah, right. So for those people who don't know, remind us who Cardinal Beaufort is and what his place in history is. Because these are not insignificant people in history, are they?
No, absolutely no. So he was the son of John of Gaunt. So if you like the Plantagenets or anything to do with Catherine or anything like that, then he is somebody that you'll hear a lot of. So he was a really, really powerful man. Really powerful man, connected to royalty. He was a cardinal. He was involved in the ruling of England. You know, he wasn't an insignificant man, and he was very, very rich. So where we have the last prior next to him,
in a very simple stone tomb. I mean, very simple. Just like, it's just simple coffin shape, isn't it?
Absolutely. So when you compare the two, you have this grand chantry chapel with this coloured effigy of Cardinal Beaufort looking very much alive next to this very simple stone tomb. It sort of, it gives you that comparison, doesn't it? Between the two different ways of thinking. Yeah, absolutely.
I couldn't help noticing some beautiful carving. It looks a little bit Tudoresque, the doorway. I mean, it's gorgeous with these lovely coat of arms. Another chantry chapel. Can you tell us a little bit about who that is dedicated to?
Yes, so that is Bishop Langton, who was, again, another very important bishop here in Winchester, very powerful man. And he chose this chapel, which was already a chapel in itself, dedicated to St. Baranus, to be his chantry chapel. So he decided, I'm going to have that, remodelled it, and made it his chantry chapel. And he was the chaplain to Edward IV and was sent on lots of diplomatic missions to France to try and arrange the marriage between Elizabeth of York and Edward IV's eldest daughter and the Dauphin.
The Dauphin of France.
Yeah.
Okay, wonderful. You can tell it was a pre-existing chapel and how he's just come along and put all this gorgeous ornate wooden carving in.
It's very flash, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very flash indeed. So we've just come, well, just a few paces on from the other chantry chapels that we've been talking about, and I'm in front of Bishop Fox's chantry chapel. And this is, actually, I've taken a picture of this door before. This is featured extensively on my Instagram account. And we just had the verger come through, and you could hear the jangling of the door as the chapel door was opened. It's a beauty, this one. Now, Bishop Fox, I know that name because you were talking about him with regards to the ceiling,
yes,
were you not?
Yes, absolutely, yes. So in those days, so we're talking 1500s, if you had a bishop that decided, well, actually, I would like the newest architectural style in my cathedral, I'm just going to remodel everything, then he had the power and the money to do that. So that's what he did. So yes, the nave and a lot of the architectural, Gothic architectural style in the cathedral is down to Bishop Fox. Not him solely, but a lot of it is. And when you see the pelican anywhere, especially on his chantry, you'll see lots of them, you know that that is
I can
his
see
stamp.
A whole row of pelicans
absolutely.
Right at the top.
They're
there
absolutely everywhere, yeah,
and it looks beautiful inside. You can't get into these chantry chapels,
no,
can you?
No,
many of them you can see mm-hmm. from the outside mm-hmm. But you can get a feel for the beautiful architecture inside. And I can see the bosses on the ceiling there, the pelican. So just looking at Richard Fox's dates, he was Bishop of Winchester here 1501 to 1528, which means he must have spanned two reigns, both of Henry VII and Henry VIII.
Yes, absolutely. He was secretary and keeper of the seal to both King Henry VII and King Henry VIII. And he was present at the baptism of Henry's son, Prince Arthur, here at Winchester Cathedral in 1486 as well.
Gosh, you know, I'm really glad you reminded me of that, because I've forgotten, of course, Prince Arthur was born here at Winchester. That was all part of Henry allying himself with English tradition.
Absolutely.
And his kind of imposing the fact, yes, I am the rightful King of England. He did so much of that early on in his reign, and that was just another part of it. So fantastic. So we've got a christening, and we've got a marriage, and we've got a consecration.
Yay!
All during the Tudor period and all here at Winchester. That's brilliant.
Fabulous.
That's a full house as far as I'm concerned. We only needed a death, really, but, you know, I'm going to look that over. We've had enough chantry chapels. I think we'll deal with
that. We'll stop with that. Yeah.
Post-dissolution, it would be good to round up our story by just talking about what happened to the cathedral, because I know you were mentioning earlier that actually for a period of time during the Civil War, it wasn't even a cathedral at all.
No, it suffered a lot during the English Civil War, and it was actually sacked twice because Winchester supported King Charles I and King Charles II. When the parliamentarians came to Winchester, they caused a lot of problems here. So the first sacking was in 1642 by William Waller, and then the second one was in 1645 by Oliver Cromwell.
Right.
And so after William Waller was here, we actually had a period of time where the cathedral wasn't actually used as a church. It was used as a stable for the parliamentarian troops. It was also a brewery, and it wasn't treated with the utmost respect. So when you go to different parts of the cathedral, you can see graffiti, a lot of graffiti from that time, because it wasn't respected in the way that it was before.
I think it's one of the darkest periods in our history. We lost so much, didn't we? So much historical monuments and buildings and so on. Oh, wow. So happily, that didn't go on forever. And we now have the restored cathedral here to enjoy. Now, maybe you want to tell us something about how people can, come and visit the cathedral. How can they find information about maybe some of the exhibitions that you might have going on? And in fact, do you have an exhibition going on here at the moment that you might want people to know about?
Well, the best place to go is our website. So we have a What's On page on our website that shows what's going on in the cathedral. We also have a Facebook and a Twitter life age, and we have a TikTok now as well, which is good. So those are the best places to go to find out about different specialist tours. So we do tower tours, we do crypt tours as well, and we do different workshops throughout the year, school visits, all sorts of stuff going on all throughout the year, and obviously our services as well, which happen 3 times a day.
Right. Lovely. Thank you so much. Well, it's been an honour to be here today. Thank you so much for showing us around and pointing out some of the highlights that our listeners hopefully can listen to when they come and visit for themselves.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much.
Well, my friends, that's all from Winchester and Winchester Cathedral for today. Thank you so much to Aisha for showing us around and regaling us with tales from this magnificent cathedral. Just on one note, I really do love Winchester for its chantry chapels. It's hard to beat. So if you have any interest in exploring such things, then I highly recommend you put Winchester on your map. Not least to say there are so many other historic places to explore in Winchester. And in fact, a little later on in the year, you will be able to enjoy my write-up of a Tudor weekend away in Winchester in my itineraries by county and by time, if you are a road trip traveller. All right, that's all for this month. Thank you so much for your company, and I look forward to seeing you again in June. First of all, it's a big thank you to all of you who bought tickets for this year's virtual annual summit. Of course, 500 Years of Anne Boleyn, It Girl, Icon, Legend, which is underway right now this weekend as this episode goes live.